G'day, Paul Barclay here. Welcome to Big Ideas on RN, online or on your pod. When you think of the Renaissance, what springs to mind? Arts, culture, the sciences? Probably not accounting. It's not something you normally associate with the golden age of creativity, but you should, according to writer Jane Gleeson White. The story begins in 1492, the year Luca Piccoli, one of the great mathematicians of the age and a close friend of Leonardo da Vinci, first formalised the Venetian method of accounting, known today as double entry, and it marks a pivotal point in the history of commerce and indeed capitalism. Prior to double entry, a merchant would either write down, in diary style, what money was owed or spent, usually in chronological order. Or they might try and use their memory to keep track of their transactions. The advent of double entry meant profit and loss could easily be calculated, and in a glance you could see whether a business was a going concern or not. This system is still in use today and forms the basis of how accounts are kept and managed. Tonight on Big Ideas, Jane Gleeson White talks about her book Double Entry, how the merchants of Venice shaped the modern world and how their invention could make or break the planet. This fascinating conversation ranges from 15th century Venice through to the Industrial Revolution and on to the Second World War and the development of national accounts figures. You'll hear arguments in favour of updating accountancy practice so that social and environmental costs are recognised. It's called triple bottom line accounting. As Jane Gleeson White notes, accountants can ruin the world by the wrong measure or save it by getting it right. Let's head now to the I.O. Meyer studio at the University of New South Wales, and introducing Jane and her book Double Entry is Professor Jeff Harcourt.
Jane's book is extraordinarily scholarly, it's beautifully written, and it is full of profound insights and intuitions, economic intuition of a very deep sort. She twigged, as we got a glimpse of when we started, that without double entry bookkeeping you wouldn't have had capitalism, and without capitalism you mightn't have had double entry bookkeeping. There was a mutual determination process going on. Double entry played an enormous role in the development of capitalism, then the rise of the accounting profession, and now, which is the wonderfully humane and moving climax to her book, the accountants may either save us or doom us to extinction. And that leads us into the current debates on sustainable consumption. But not only that, the history and so on that Jane reveals, and as a good Marxist, because she did political economy at Sydney, she concentrates on the central concept of the surplus early on and its relationship to double entry bookkeeping. Also, when we get to the end of her book, I find myself in the company of people who were my colleagues in Cambridge, my contemporary PhD students, Amartya Sen, Joe Stiglitz, who had a room next to me in 1950, Sir Partha Dasgupta, FRS, and a fellow of the British Academy, having won every glittering prize except the Nobel Prize. So if you've got a bit of money to spare, try Ladbrokes. they all figure prominently in the end. Richard Stone and James Mead, who made up the National Accounts of the UK. So you can imagine the excitement I had when I read this. Now, I'm going to pass over to Jane because it's her book and her researchers. I just hold her up as a model of how to do thorough archival research and apply intelligence and beautiful narrative writing to making alive very important issues. So over to you, Jane. Perhaps you might just tell us briefly how you got onto it. And also, I hope you'll read us some passages, or key passages, from the book, because they're so worthwhile hearing.
Thank you, Jeff. First of all, I'll say that, well, I'm not going to deflect the nice comments that you've made about my book, but I think there's a lot more intuition, which is one of the words you use to describe my insights, than profound thought. But yes, a hell of a lot of research went into it. My other major area of interest is literature. So it was a very, although I do have an economics degree and obviously an interest in economics, so it was a very unexpected area for me to be considering writing a book on, especially something as unlikely as double entry bookkeeping and accounting. But the way that I came to it was actually, like Jeff, it was in an accounting lecture, but it was in the context of having worked in Venice at the Guggenheim, the Peggy Guggenheim Museum of Modern Art. So I had spent 3 months working in what to me was the most extraordinary city on earth, immersed in Renaissance art as well as working every day, you know, in a modern art gallery. And so to me, Venice was the ultimate place of art and culture, and I hadn't really noticed, well, it didn't even occur to me, the great wealth that underpinned it. I just saw it manifested everywhere. So then when I returned to Australia the next year and started my economics degree and was sitting in an accounting lecture, and my very entertaining accountant who had my attention for the whole year, unlike yours.
My definition of an accountant is an accountant is an economist with a sense of humour.
Well, anyway, this one definitely had a sense of humour. He was very engaging. And he happened to mention the word Venice in association with the origin of double entry bookkeeping and some illustrious person that was involved, you know, that had published a book in Venice. And for some reason, because it was Venice, and Venice was in my mind, and accounting seemed, you know, the polar opposite of Venice because, you know, as you say, accountant, well, I'd say economists are accountants with a sense of humour, but forgive any accountants or economists who might be in the audience. So that just seemed so unlikely that these two things should be connected that they just caught my very perverse imagination. And I thought, so that was my first ever idea for a book apart from all the novels that I'm always writing. But it seemed, you know, I couldn't ever imagine pitching the idea of a book on double entry bookkeeping to my publisher, Jane Palfreyman, who publishes Christos Tsolkas and various other sort of works of cutting edge fiction. It seemed most unlikely. Anyway, but eventually I did look into it a little more beyond the superficial, you know, connection between Venice and Pacioli. And I found the most extraordinary story that not only went backwards to the beginning of writing in Mesopotamia, you know, about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, but also went forwards. You know, I sort of followed the idea to its logical conclusion, and it ended up, as Jeff said, most unexpectedly but most delightfully to me, with this idea of environmental accounting and the idea that accountants could possibly save the planet where everybody else had failed, which was also a very exciting idea. So will I sort of set the scene with Pacioli? Is that...
Yeah, yeah? Well, he's such a fascinating and important guy. And do tell him, you know, who taught him and, you know, your favourite painter and then your favourite scientist from then.
Well...
They're all associated with him.
Yeah, see, Pacioli... Because his life is in set in such a complex century that we're mostly familiar, which is the 15th century, he was born in about 1444, and we're mostly familiar with that as an era of great, you know, painting and scholarship, but we're not so familiar with the idea that, or with the fact that this was also a century of a revolution in mathematics and also in printing, which we do know, in communications. But the mathematics that was so significant in this era had arrived in Italy about 200 years earlier, but had actually been banned by the church because it was Hindu Arabic numerals that we're also familiar with today. And they were used by merchants, but they weren't permitted to be used by scholars. So that was the context in which Pacioli was writing, in a context where the guilds had outlawed these numbers and the church because they thought that they were more open to tampering, and also, I suspect, because they came from the East, from the infidel. Because there's so much context of Pacioli's life that I've had to weave into this section, I'll just read you sort of fragments to position him in his century in the context of this new mathematics, of which he was the greatest encyclopedist of the Renaissance, and also in the context of Venice, which in the 15th century, and I didn't realise this, but I may have been the only ignorant one on earth, was... The Wall Street was the New York of the world, and its Rialto was the Wall Street. So I've just been talking about these Hindu Arabic numbers and the fact that they've been outlawed. But however, the use of Hindu Arabic numerals was advocated by the man who in 1494 codified the state-of-the-art bookkeeping practices of Venice. By the 1430s, the merchants of Venice had perfected a system of double-entry account keeping in two columns, which became known as bookkeeping alla Veneziana, the Venetian method. It is this Venetian method that, through its extraordinary resilience and mutability, has come down to us today, transformed over several centuries from a rudimentary business tool into an efficient calculating machine. The man responsible for its codification and preservation, the author of the world's first printed bookkeeping treatise, is Luca Bartolomeo de Pacioli, Renaissance mathematician, monk, magician, constant companion of Leonardo da Vinci. As the origin of all subsequent bookkeeping treatises throughout Europe, Luca Pacioli's bookkeeping tract is not only the source of modern accounting, but also ensured the medieval Venetian method itself survived into our times. And so accountants have named Luca Pacioli the father of accounting. And any story of double entry must pay him particular attention. And it's worth examining in some detail not only Pacioli's life, but also his times, because in his century, Italy was shaken by a renaissance in mathematics and a communications revolution, which both bore directly on the staying power of double entry itself. And I could read other passages of his travels to Venice, where he learnt bookkeeping from a merchant who had employed him as a 19-year-old student to teach his sons bookkeeping and mathematics. But I might just take up Jeff's mention of his illustrious teacher, who was Piero della Francesca, one of the great mathematicians, one of the three great mathematician artists of the Renaissance, the other being Leonardo da Vinci, who was, as I said, Luca Pacioli's constant companion, and who probably, and I say definitely, learnt mathematics from Luca Pacioli. So there's this incredible sort of interplay between my favourite artist, the third great artist mathematician was Dürer, and Luca Pacioli is also implicated in his life and very possibly also taught him mathematics in Venice in the 1490s. So there's, you know, so Luca Pacioli, who we don't really know about, was not only the father of accounting, he was the great mathematical encyclopedist of the Renaissance and also the foremost expert on the mathematics for the art of perspective painting, you know, which was the new way of painting things that appeared to be in three dimensions instead of in two dimensions, most beautifully executed by Leonardo da Vinci in his Last Supper in Milan, which Pacioli was present throughout, you know, the creation of that. Yeah.
He's not one of the models.
Well, very possibly.
Yes. No, I was in the penultimate supper. There were 60 people there.
But the key thing that double entry bookkeeping made possible was the calculation of profit, so that at the end of a period, a merchant could see, you know, whether his business was a going concern or not. And the thing that distinguished it from the previous forms of account keeping was this ability to sort of at a glance. So the Venetian system was different from the foregoing systems because it had a bilateral ledger that from which you could tell how your business was going at a glance, and I think that was a key thing, and it allowed for the calculation of profit, whereas previously in Italy there had been accounts kept in paragraph form, more like diaries. They were sort of narrative records of a merchant's affairs, and when a merchant was just a single man in a you know, fixed place, that was, you know, either he kept his accounts in his head or he just made diary entries to keep track of his business. But once the Italian merchants became, you know, active from the Cotswolds across to China, then they needed much more sophisticated systems, and this double entry bookkeeping was the thing they used. So yeah, it allowed them to see their profit at a glance. Is that what you're angling at?
That's what I was getting at, yes. Yeah, one of the things that comes out of Jane's book as far as accounting and economic concepts are concerned is the great necessity to distinguish between stocks and flows, and What double entry shows you is that profit and loss are flows of expenditure, ingoings and outgoings, whereas balance sheets are stocks, a sight at the moment of time. And the best economists have always talked about the very important interrelationships between stocks and flows, and that comes out of double entry bookkeeping. And also, of course, in modern accounting, another very important concept is what they call the flow of funds statements, which shows funds coming in and the uses of those funds, both for current purposes but also for capital accumulation. Because, as you know, Marx, and here I'm talking about Karl, not Groucho, or if there are any students here, hi. Marx, is one of his most famous remarks, is accumulate, accumulate, that is Moses and the prophets. The whole point about understanding capitalism, this comes out of Marx rather than out of mainstream economics, is that the decision makers and the drivers are ruthless and swashbuckling capitalists, industrial, commercial, financial. And one of Marx's great insights, and this is where double entry is very important and keeping accounts, is that if financial capital gets out of kilter with industrial and commercial capital, instability and sometimes crisis occurs. I rest my case.
Yeah.
We're living through such a period at the moment. And one of my recent papers has been on what would Marx and Keynes have told us about the last 30 years as opposed to mainstream economists.
Oh.
I think that they had far greater insights. And Keynes is one of your heroes, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of mine too. While we're talking about Keynes, and I'll shut up, but while we're talking about Keynes, his great... The principal propositions of his most famous book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, were independently discovered by a Marxist Polish economist, who's Peter and my greatest hero, Michał Kalecki, who I think was the greatest all-round economist of the 20th century. But he came out of Marx, and one of Marx's use of double entry was in volume two, which was only published after he died by his mate Engels, uses the concept of what he called the schemes of reproduction. And in that, he divides the economy into the production of capital goods, production of consumption goods, and production of luxury goods. And he shows, he works out the conditions under which it would be true that the total amount produced and the composition of the total amount of produced would be bought either directly or indirectly by the three departments. And of course, he's not saying this is how capitalism works. What he's saying is, it'll only be a fluke if those conditions are established by individual capitalists doing their own thing. And if they don't do it, then you're going to have instability and crisis. So again, double entry is very important for understanding why capitalism, while it is a remarkable producer of goods and services and so on, is nevertheless at its basis a very irrational and unjust and cruel system if it's left to itself. Now, Keynes, who was a liberal, as his great biographer Skidelsky calls him, the last of the English liberals, he wanted to save capitalism from itself. Of course, Marx rubbed his hands and said it's full of basic contradictions, and if we just wait long enough, it'll blow up. We're still waiting, but you know.
Well, Keynes keeps tempering it.
Well, there you go. It's all Keynes. It's for, yeah, yeah. Now, because Keynes could never understand Marx. He was very, very rude about him. And when my mentor, Joan Robinson, sent her her book on Keynes, on Marx, an essay on Marxian economics, he wrote to her and said, well, that's the best thing you've written so far, and it's very interesting, which is strange, because how can you make something which is basically wrong other than boring? Well, I think that reflects much more on Keynes.
Absolutely.
Than on Marx, but there we are.
There was a German economist at the beginning of the 20th century called Sombart, who I hadn't heard of before. He's sort of like...
Werner Sombart.
Has not been widely translated, has not at all been translated into English. For good reasons, mostly related to his political persuasion as a German.
It was the right of Genghis Khan.
Yeah, but he made some really fascinating allegations about double entry bookkeeping and capitalism that, you know, so as I sort of followed the trail of double entry from Pacioli through the years that his treatise became widespread in Europe and became the standard practice, and then through the Industrial Revolution when it was applied to factories and the new form of business, which was a corporation, or the joint stock corporation, the joint stock company.
Joint stock company.
And, you know, so it was all fascinating and exciting and amazing, and I just couldn't believe this tiny little Venetian relic continued to find ways of, you know, of being central to business and economics in
limited
Europe.
Liability.
Yeah, I mean, everything depreciate. I mean, you know, it just proved to be this extraordinarily flexible and adaptable tool. And then, but I was very, very excited to discover Sombart, and then to discover that Marx, although he doesn't mention, as far as I know, but you will correct me, double entry bookkeeping in Das Kapital.
No, he does
refer to it often in his letters to Engels and ask that Engels send him the accounts of his family...
The cotton firm.
Yeah, yeah. Of his family cotton mill in Manchester, which I just found fascinating. And so it means that Marx was sort of drawing... So he already had his theoretical vision of how he thought capitalism worked, but he was looking at actual double entry accounts from Engels' state-of-the-art family cotton factory in Manchester to see how businessmen actually, and excuse me, they mostly all were businessmen, I think exceptionally, otherwise I'd say business people, but how the business people of Manchester in the 1850s or so were keeping their books and how they were dealing with profit and how they were accounting for them. And so he drew a lot of, I think, possibly comfort from seeing the way that his theoretical views were actually practiced.
Now, did Marx see limited liability come in? I suppose he did. See, if you don't have limited liability, if a firm goes bung, the shareholders are just bankrupt, are ruined as well. Whereas with limited liability, you're only up for the shares that you hold.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think Europe was ahead of England with limited liability. And certainly...
The Brits would never admit that, but you're probably right.
Well, I think they'd been burnt by earlier experiences like... Yeah.
But also in Tawney and Weber, there's a connection between religion and the rise of capitalism, as well as bookkeeping of the rise of capitalism, yes.
I mean, it was... Anyway, so, will I just read a little bit from this capitalism chapter, which is when I started to get really excited. So this is the bit about Sombart, and it goes for a couple of pages. In 1902, a most intriguing claim was made on behalf of double entry. It was proposed by a German economist, Werner Sombart, in his six-volume work on capitalism, De Modern Capitalismus. In six pages, Sombart set out his belief that the emergence of capitalism and the appearance of double-entry bookkeeping in the 13th century are causally related. He wrote, "It is simply impossible to imagine capitalism without double-entry bookkeeping. They are like form and content. In Sombart's view, capitalism and double-entry are so intimately connected, it is difficult to tell which was cause and which effect. One may indeed doubt whether capitalism has procured in double-entry bookkeeping a tool which activates its forces, or whether double-entry bookkeeping has first given rise to capitalism out of its own spirit." Sombart defines capitalism as, and I'm quoting, "a particular economic system recognisable as an organisation of trade consisting invariably of two collaborating sections of the population, the owners of the means of production, who also manage them, and propertyless workers bound to the markets which they serve, which displays two prominent dominant principles of wealth creation and economic rationalism." Sombart's definition, as anyone who knows Marx will gather, derives from Karl Marx. Friedrich Engels, Marx's collaborator and editor, wrote of Sombart's work, "It is the first time that a German professor succeeds on the whole in seeing in Marx's writing what Marx really says." Yeah. But Sombart took his claims for double entry bookkeeping much further, and they were also very exciting to me, so I'll just read a couple more paragraphs about that. According to Sombart, capitalism originated with double entry bookkeeping, which created the category of capital, or that amount of wealth which is used in making profits and which enters into the accounts. Not content merely with assigning double entry a foundational role in the capitalist economy, Sombart also accords bookkeeping the same parentage as modern science, arguing that double entry bookkeeping was born of the same spirit as the systems of Galileo and Newton and the modern schools of physics and chemistry. In fact, he goes further still, suggesting that double entry itself was the germ of the scientific revolution of the 16th century. And I quote again, "Without looking too closely, one might already glimpse in double entry bookkeeping the ideas of gravitation, the circulation of blood, and energy conservation." What Sombart means by this extravagant claim is that through its encouragement of regular record keeping, mathematical order, and the reduction of events to numbers abstracted from time and place, double entry fostered a new view of the world as being subject to quantification. And it was this urge to abstract and quantify natural phenomena that lay at the heart of the scientific revolution. Oswald Spengler makes a similar claim in The Decline of the West, where he equates Pacioli with Copernicus. So when we put together all the claims Sombart made on behalf of double entry bookkeeping, this, you know, essentially medieval technical procedure that was born in northern Italy, we see that he is effectively arguing that it gave birth to the entire modern scientific capitalist world. In particular, he says that by enabling a numerical, monetary, and hence, in his view, rational calculation of profit, double entry bookkeeping provided the basis on which commerce could be seen as a process of acquisition, as an unending, systematic pursuit of profit. Mm. And we live with the consequences. Yes.
But we should also say that when Keynes was writing and so on, one of the things that made it possible for his work to be used for policy purposes was the simultaneous development of the idea of the national accounts.
Yeah.
And this was very important in the Second World War because it helped to see what resources were and were not available for the war effort. And that's when two of my older colleagues, Richard Stone and James Mead, calculated in 1940 the first national accounts for the UK to be used by the war effort. And Joan Robinson's husband, Austin Robinson, a very famous and lovely man, economist, he said his greatest contribution to the war effort was to get these two young fellas to make up these national accounts.
Really?
Yes. And I must tell you a story about Dick Stone. He was a complete dandy, Homburg hats, bow ties, Savile Row suits. But anyway, he was coming into work with me one day on the national accounts and he got caught in an air raid. And as he walked in, he took off his Homburg hat and he dusted it off and put it up on the hook that he had for it. And he said, "Really, James, they've gone too far this time." So the national accounts are extraordinarily important, and for their wartime purposes, they're absolutely indispensable. And I must say that there were some Australian adopted economists associated with Sir Jack Crawford and also Colin Clark, who was an Englishman but who came out to Queensland to advise Bonky Joe, amongst others, I think. Yeah. But they also did early studies of national accounts, as well as Mead and Stone, and of course Simon Kuznets, both he and Stone got the Nobel Prize. Then they fell into disrepute, as you quote Robert Kennedy on just before he was killed, because capturing everything with money, or being able to measure it, and if there are things which aren't measured or aren't appropriate to add to our well-being. For example, pollution is not captured, but it is put out by factories, but it's not counted as a cost of production in the national accounts. And producing armaments, all sorts of things are regarded as positive, a part of the measurement of our well-being, and there's a huge gap between it. Now, The best economists always understood that. But what they are now working on, and Jane describes this with great passion at the end of her work, is how do we adjust doing our national accounts to take in the fact that we are ruining the environment in the process, so that we know where we're going. We'll have some measure of being able to create a sustainable environment while at the same time raise the wretched of the earth, who the majority of the earth, raise their standard of living to something which is livable with. So that is the, along with global warming, which is connected with it, this is the number one problem of our time, and to which the best economists now are addressing. There's the Stern report, there's Bill Nordhaus's work in the States, there's a madman at MIT who I'm very fond of called Marty Weinstein. They're all working on it, and it is absolutely of major, absolutely fundamental importance if the world is going to be saved. And that's why you said the accountants can either ruin the world by wrong measure or save it by getting the measurement right. But we must keep one of the great gifts of the Enlightenment, which is you do need to measure things in order to have a scientific study to things. But of course, there is two ways of knowing things at least. One is the scientific way, but there's also, and this is why you span both cultures in C.P. Snow's ridiculous dichotomy, knowledge through intuition, through poetry, and even, dare I say it, they'll get murdered by Raja, through religious insight. And they need to be combined in order to in order for us to have a full understanding of the human condition and what we can do to preserve it.
Yeah, that was another exciting moment in my journey with Double Entry, was discovering that this same Venetian technique was applied by Stone and Kuznets and others to construct these national accounts during the Depression, first of all in America with Roosevelt's New Deal, and then in the United Kingdom under the sort of guidance of Keynes with his general theory during the Second World War. And you know, the figures that they generate, which we commonly call the GDP, which is the measure of economic growth, or which they enable that measure to be made, I discovered that this GDP figure had really only been around since the Second World War, and had gradually, these accounts had been spread to every nation on earth under the aegis of the United Nations, set up after the Second World War. And that we sort of take this GDP accounting for granted. We take the idea of economic growth, which I'm not sure what your position is on economic growth, but I would contest it as the basis of life on Earth. I think the idea of this endless economic growth.
Yeah, no. I mean, Victoria Chick has just written a lovely paper comparing the ideal end states of Keynes in the economic possibilities for our grandchildren and Fritz Schumacher, Small is Beautiful. They both had visions of what the ideal world was. See, Keynes thought, you've got to solve the economic problem so we're all relatively well off, but then you can get on with the real business of life, which, since he belonged to the Bloomsbury Circle, you know, Noel Annan once said, the Bloomsbury Circle lived in squares and loved in triangles. And he thought, you know, let's get rid of money making, which he had a Freudian explanation of it. It was anal retentive or something. Let's get rid of that and let's get on with friendship and beautiful objects and using our leisure properly. And Schumacher similarly thought that Small was beautiful, but once you get to a certain standard of living, let's get on with being human beings. So I agree with you. I mean, growth is necessary, but it is a means to an end. And when we've solved sustainable consumption at levels which, I mean, we rich people in the West cannot stop, or should not anyway stop the majority of people who are still undernourished and haven't got proper services, haven't got proper of any sort, and go to bed hungry and so on. We've got to solve that, but then we've got to settle down to having a sensible, civilized system.
Just to give some flavour of what Jeff's talking about with the national accounts, I think Robert Kennedy did summarise it very poetically in a speech that he made 3 months before he was assassinated about the GNP and the flaws in using it as a measure of a nation's well-being. So this was in 1968 when America was, you know, the richest country in the world, and obviously probably still is, maybe. Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year, but that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm and counts nuclear warheads and armoured cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck's knife and the television programmes which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And that, you know, is so resonant for me, especially as a lover of most of the intangible goods that don't get measured by the GNP. And the reason that I've muddied my hands with economics and accounting is because, you know, I care so much about these other things, and it feels that we're living in a world that has, you know, is governed by numbers and accounts and money. And, you know, for example, the recent announcement by the new Premier of Queensland that he was going to abolish the literary awards is just a classic one of a gazillion examples of how this sort of thinking that I argue came from Luca Pacioli's Double Entry Bookkeeping Treatise and The Merchants of Venice is infecting our lives. And I'm sure anyone who's an academic here would experience it every day in your academic departments and universities. You know, anyone who has children who go to school experiences these terrible kind of cost-cutting measures that value profits and money over well-being and health and sanity. And, you know, so I'm not sure that it's possible to put a price on all these things that we value so much, but I think it's really important that we know the mechanisms that generate the numbers that are kind of crushing these things. In fact, there's a chilling and beautiful quote in here somewhere, which I haven't got marked, so I won't try and find it, by Schumpeter, I think it is, on exactly this, you know.
Well, and of course, the Kennedys were great friends of John Kenneth Galbraith, and the theme in Robert Kennedy is taken straight from the Affluent Society, his book, which he published in the 50s.
You're with Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radionational. Our Twitter address is at @RNBigIdeas. I'm Paul Barclay, and tonight your guest is Jane Gleeson-White, discussing Double Entry, A History of Accounting, with University of New South Wales economist Jeff Harcourt. Let's return now to the University of New South Wales and hear what the audience has to say.
The question I wanted to ask you, Jane, is it's clear why your book would thrill economists and accountants. However, it has enjoyed a far more widespread success and accumulated a form of literary capital, which I guess will be surprising.
It's baffling.
Given the content. So I want to ask, are you surprised, and do you have any reasons why you think it may have captured a kind of broader audience? And in a kind of tangentially but potentially related question, do you spend any time discussing the rise of capitalism in relation to the rise of democracy?
Am I surprised? I'm completely... look, I was surprised when my publisher said that she would be happy to publish this book, so anything else is a surprise. And why I think it might have gone beyond, you know, the obvious readers. Although, you know, in many ways I wrote it for the general reader, and I'm actually possibly more surprised that the specialist readers, including the professors of accounting at Sydney Uni and Jeff and, you know, some of these people have taken it up. And I can only imagine that it's the racy title. Or I actually think that it's a kind of found its time. I think with the crash in 2008 and with all this talk about environmental, you know, crisis and climate change, and, you know, the book sort of encompasses it all. Just starting from, you know, it's weird because I first had the idea about 15 years ago, and half the research I wouldn't have been able to have done because accounting history is kind of a new academic field, because, as you know, in academia we're all, you know, working at the margins. So accounting history is kind of this new marginal area of accounting. And also it wouldn't have really been timely. I think it's a time, you know, people want to talk about economics for the first time since, you know, my friends didn't even know I had an economics degree. That's how little people wanted to talk about economics before, you know, 2008.
Conversation stopper, I can assure you.
Yeah. So, I mean, they literally didn't know. They thought I was an imposter writing about something. Well, I don't know as much as Jeff, obviously, or anyone about this subject, but I found it interesting. And the third question I've now immediately forgotten, which was...
Do you spend any time discussing the relation between the rise of capitalism and the rise of democracy?
No, but that is an incredibly interesting question. And might sort of be implied at various stages in my book, because especially in northern Italy, I think one of the driving forces of this new form of wealth creation, you know, the merchants of Venice, was the fact that their city-states like Pisa and Venice and Florence and Milan, Genoa, became independent from the church around the time of the Crusades. So, you know, so already they're freeing themselves from external constraints and, for want of a better way of putting it, probably finding a more democratic, but based on wealthy individuals mostly, a way of governing their estates, I suppose, their cities. So, I mean, I think it's implied in my book, but I don't overtly pursue it.
It's a very controversial question, because the farther to the right you are, the more you say there you can't...
You can't, and
vice versa. The farther to the left you get, they say no. I mean, it's not that they're against democracy, but it's not necessary. And indeed, for example, Galbraith, who was a true democrat, said that the Russian system, or the Soviet Union system, was very successful while you only had to meet rudimentary things like make steel and house and education and so on. Where it fell apart was when you got into consumer things. And then Sen has an idea that they have to go together. But my colleague in Cambridge, Peter Nolan, who's a leading authority on China and the Soviet Union, is one of his best books is China's Rise, Russia's Fall. He argues no, it's not necessary, and indeed it may be it may hold you back on development, and he gets this out of Adam Smith, the great, supposedly by the vulgar Smithians, who've probably heard of The Wealth of Nations but never read The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is a compliment to it. And I think Peter probably gets the better of the argument. And I'm a democrat. I'm a Christian democratic socialist, have been since I was at Melbourne University. But we have to say that it is not absolutely necessary. And one of the reasons why China is doing well, and that's nowhere near anything like a democracy, but it's pragmatic in the way it's creating capitalist modes and state-controlled modes. And that's one of the secrets of its success since Mao left.
I just wanted to ask you about Pacioli himself. He seems like a fascinating character, and I hadn't heard a lot about him. Has he appeared much in kind of historical fiction, or anybody made movies about him, written books about him, anything like that?
No, that is the most extraordinary part of my whole experience, you know, with this book. There's only one biography written, and it was written in 1942 by a very sort of if there could be such a thing, romantic accountant who who seemed to walk every path that Pacioli had ever trod. He took himself to Italy, as I did. Of course, you have to go to Italy if you're going to work on Luca Pacioli. But he writes in great detail about, you know, the rock that Pacioli might have seen when he looked out the window when he was writing his great treatise, and, you know, extrapolates on so many things. It's just incredible. He's very wordy, mostly unreliable, according to much more scholarly Pacioli experts. So, but, you know, it's, I wouldn't even call it a racy read, but it's kind of, you know, interesting history. But truly, you know, here is a man who was the best friend of Leonardo da Vinci, lived with him in Milan. Leonardo da Vinci called him to Milan after reading his great Encyclopedia of Mathematics, was probably taught, if not taught by, grew up in the same town as, and was influenced by, Piero della Francesca, you know, according to Aldous Huxley, who painted the best picture in the world, and also Dürer. But anyway, so he has this extraordinary life, and I can only imagine that the reason that he's not more widely known is because of Vasari, who wrote the, you know, famously, the portraits of the artists, of the great painters. And in his chapter on Piero della Francesca, the first page, I think, says, Luca Pacioli is a scurrilous plagiarist, and he totally ripped off Piero della Francesca, and that has kind of cast a terrible pall over Pacioli ever since. And, you know, so it's I'm dealing with a plagiarist here. But I contend, and so do other people much wiser than I, that he actually, most of his work was original.
Wasn't the development of double entry accounting inevitable? If Pacioli hadn't invented it, somebody else would have.
Yeah,
and that's true, and especially as it was being practiced in northern Italy, in Florence and other places, Genoa, since about 1300. So. But it was sort of perfected or developed to a certain extent in Venice, and that was the version that Pacioli chose to formulate. So, yes, I think it probably would have, but, you know, it's also possible that no one would have bothered to actually... So Pacioli didn't actually invent it. He formulated what was already in practice. And it's possible that no one would have bothered to, or if they did, it would have been a different sort. But yes, I think that's a very good point. And Pacioli is more like, you know, the symbolic sort of incarnation of double entry bookkeeping. Although, according to some accountants, but not all, you know, just on the basis of his 27-page treatise published in 1494, we could, you know, work today's accounts. You know, so I mean, it was obviously very succinct. And although this is, I know, a contentious thing to say, because I know a lot of people don't think that that is the case. But anyway, so I think he did it very well, is what I'm saying. And then it spread throughout Europe because of the printing press, you see, which had only just been invented. So it made his version the standard version.
I think it's fascinating, your account. I haven't read the book. I look forward to reading it. But to pursue the idea that the double entry bookkeeping is what helped the development of capitalism a bit further, at the time that you're talking about the Italian Pacioli, who I don't know, that would have been shopkeeper time, when we didn't have what at least Marx would have called capitalism or developed capitalism. And I think about, and I'm sure you'd agree, that we need the creation of surplus that has to take place first. Now, in those days, in the 13th or 14th or whatever, 15th century, they were still working in a more like a feudal kind of system where there wasn't...
No.
I don't know. Okay.
It was mercantile capitalism. Mm. So yeah. These merchants had, you know, they were exporting wool from the Cotswolds on credit to, you know, so they had these really sophisticated systems of credit. And, I mean, previously you would have thought as well, and I know it's kind of, I wouldn't say standard thinking, but I know that under the influence of a lot of contemporary thinking about capitalism, we kind of imagine it as happening around the middle to the end of the 18th century. But this is very sophisticated capitalistic behaviour. It's mercantile and it's different from factories and, you know, the rise of the corporation. But
this is capitalism based on trading, and this is what it's to do with selling things at higher prices than you bought them at, which is not what Marx thinks about as creation of surplus. It's just to do in the price system, not in the production system and so on.
In the sense that, and that's true, in the sense that there's no labour being involved in, the sort of factory thing, yes.
And I think Jeff mentioned it, I think limited liability is something which really gave a big spark to the development of capitalism, because you could then invest large sums of money and you could still go home without having lost anything yourself or oneself. And the other point I was going to make, which the double entry bookkeeping doesn't seem to say anything about, is the problem of distribution, which was touched on by what Jeff's comment. And that to me and to many economists nowadays is still an important point. And if you think about developing countries to say growth is good, well, for many people it's good, and some people do get out of poverty, but the distribution is so unequal.
Absolutely.
You can't just look at national income accounts, and you can't just look at double entry bookkeeping unless you look at the distributional factors.
And absolutely, I totally take your point, and I do touch on that, you know, towards the end of my book where, exactly.
Yes, thanks very much. I'm really enjoying the conversation, particularly discussion of Pierre Della Francesca and Dürer. But I'm wondering, Venice at the time was a merchant city, and I understand there was a council of Venice who perhaps shared ideas and perhaps needed to share information as well. And that may have had some impact on democratic systems in terms of accounting. I wonder, has that been considered?
So whether the political system had an impact on the economic system?
That's right.
I mean, the political system of Venice is absolutely fascinating because it, you know, it's the sort of ideal, not capitalist, but primitive capitalist or mercantile capitalist or whatever you're going to allow me to call it, system, because money, well, there's a fantastic quote that I got from some scholars of money and finance who, and it's a quote from the Doges of Venice, who say money is the lifeblood, is the sinews, nay, the lifeblood of our city. So it was the ultimate in a sort of capitalistic political system. So everything that happened, I mean, they even decreed when the ships should come to and from Venice so that they would have enough goods, you know, from the Levant and from Constantinople, which was their major trading partner. They had to come twice a year to Venice, once in the middle of the year, once at the end of the year at Christmas time, so there was enough wealth. This was all decreed by the rulers of Venice. So I don't know where democracy fits into that, but certainly economics and politics were, you know, hand in glove. And the Venetian Navy, which, you know, like the British Navy in the 19th century, was instrumental in giving Venice the power that it had at the time, was pretty much designed to accompany all its trading ships. Yeah, it was a city that above all protected the rights of merchants, and almost uniquely in Italy at the time, who were still, you know, mostly guided by the Catholic Church.
I think Groucho Marx should have the last
word. Oh yeah, I definitely do.
Groucho Marx said, "The trouble with happiness is it can't buy money."
Jane Gleeson-White talking about her recent book, Double Entry, How the Merchants of Venice Shaped the Modern World, and How Their Invention Could Make or Break the Planet. It's published in Australia by Allen and Unwin. This discussion was presented by University of New South Wales Writing and University of New South Wales School of Arts and Media. Thanks to Jeff Harcourt from the Australian School of Business at the University of New South Wales for moderating tonight's discussion, and to ABC sound recordist Marty Peralta.